Andretti Love and got really tight. Federer was there with this forehand, low part of the net. Whip. Thank you very much. I'll serve for my ninth championship. And listen to this reception.
Wimbledon, Remo. Oh, I remember it fondly when it was played.
It's a long time ago now.
How
have you been holding up without any tennis this year?
I've been okay.
Been okay?
In COVID lockdown, I've been fine.
I've been better than I thought I would. But it's glad to see that you're okay, because I was a bit worried about you there for a while.
Well, your shakes have stopped, which is a good thing.
That's true.
So what are we looking at today, Remo? We're looking at... I asked you a question. I'm going to answer it.
You often do.
Yes. The 2019 Wimbledon final between Roger Federer of Switzerland and Novak Djokovic of Serbia. Why are we looking at this final today?
I know you've got some strong opinions on this match, Buzz.
I do.
I know you've earmarked it as possibly one of the most important matches in the history of the game.
I think it will go down in future as one of the great turning points in tennis history and one that they will look back at.
And it's full of controversy, full of moments, and we're looking at it because there's no tennis on at the moment, and we feel that Wimbledon would be played now, and it's apt perhaps to revisit this monumental match at this point in time.
If Wimbledon had been held this year, people would have been dying to see a rematch of this by now. You know, Roger Federer is not getting any younger, nor am I.
No. So we're going to relive it for people out there.
Now, the number of storylines, the number of topics that this match has brought up is quite extraordinary.
Where do you want to start here?
I think we start at the very beginning.
You don't want to start at the end and work our way back?
We've tried that before, Remo. You know how that goes. No, it doesn't go well.
All right. Set the scene for me, Buzz.
A 37-year-old Roger Federer, almost 38, enters Wimbledon as number three in the world, but the number two seed, which was...
Contentious, wasn't
contentious.
It?
Contentious.
Nadal's nose was out of joint.
That's right.
I don't
right.
know if you've ever seen Nadal with his nose out of joint. It's not a pretty sight.
No. Siska has to knock it back into place.
Well, it usually ends up on the left side of his cheek.
Yeah.
It's quite extreme and scares the hell out of Uncle Tony.
Novak Djokovic, the great Serbian, number one in the world, reigning Wimbledon champion, and Roger Federer had won the previous year. So there's no question that these two were the best grass court players in the world, and two of the best ever, really, when you look at it.
Yeah, for sure.
Djokovic at that point had four titles, Federer eight, but Federer had never beaten Djokovic in a final at Wimbledon.
That's a telling fact, isn't it?
But Federer, after 2017, when he got the injury, he came back. He won Wimbledon that year. He was a different player on fast court. He was more aggressive, taking the ball earlier. His backhand was stronger. So he came into this Wimbledon, for some people, as the favourite. You've also got to look at the Grand Slam tally. Federer had 20, Djokovic 16.
Essentially, any time Nadal or Federer play, or Federer and Djokovic play, or Djokovic and Nadal play, that Grand Slam tally is hanging over their heads like a storm cloud, really, isn't it?
One more thing I'd like to mention. Before we kick in, Nadal did have something to say. He made the semi-finals against Federer, and there was a big build-up for this match. Federer won in four sets, but in the end, you would say fairly comfortably.
Yeah, except for that one set, he had him covered, I think, for sure.
Yeah, and there's no question that Djokovic and Federer have Nadal covered on fast court. So let's start at possibly the most contentious claim that Roger Federer choked.
Two of the greatest champions in our sport, but they're still entitled to get nervous.
Do you think he did? I've got a firm view on this, but I want to hear what you think before I put forward my firmness.
All right. My feeling is, and this is going to take you by surprise, that Roger Federer choked, but not where we think he did.
Okay, so you're not saying he choked on the match points.
I think you could make an argument that he choked, but I think something else was happening in those points.
Yeah.
I think he choked in the tie breaks.
Right.
And I think specifically the first set tie break.
Yeah.
He was up 5-3 and then made four errors on his forehand in a row to lose the set. And to me, that was a choke. And then in the third set tiebreaker, he lost the first two or three points equally as badly with unforced errors. I think it was in his head. Because if you look at the rest of the match, and look, we haven't covered this and maybe we did in an intro, Federer was the better player throughout the bulk of that match.
Yeah. You know, I wonder really if it's a case of terminology here. When we're talking about two supreme athletes in a final playing a wonderful caliber of tennis, is the word choke the right word? Because can you come in and out of a choke through a match? I'm not sure that you can. There are moments of highs and lows, peak moments, that you don't play the right shot, you lose some concentration. Federer in the fifth set was under enormous pressure on his serve. He comes through with flying colours. Now, I wouldn't associate that with someone who's coming in and out of chokes in a match. I just wouldn't. And I just wonder if there's something else going on in those moments that maybe we're not privy to, we don't understand. I'm just throwing it out there, you know?
Previously, I may not have agreed with that. I do, after watching agree with it. And I think when you're looking at the fifth set in the fourth hour, maybe, fifth hour of a match.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say, and I think it supports this, is that you could make the equal claim that in the fifth set, Roger Federer was broken early. Novak Djokovic played an awful service game to be broken back. Mm. Now, that to me was a bigger choke.
Or is it a lapse of concentration?
I don't think Federer choked on the match points in that game. Mm. I think it was his tactics. I don't think he went hard enough.
Yeah, which is a totally different thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay, in that first match point, at 40-15, he served wide to Djokovic, who hit his forehand back. He was obviously taken out of court.
Mm.
Federer played an off forehand that was curling away down the backhand side.
Mm.
And he'd done that before in the tiebreak of the previous set, which hadn't worked. It had just gone out. And this time, again, it just faded out. But the way Federer sort of hopped after he hit it, there was a lot of hope in it rather than conviction. Second one, the famous approach shot, which was not a great approach shot. It was a fantastic shot by Djokovic under the circumstances, but it was there to be hit. What do you think of that shot?
I thought it was the right play from Federer. And to me, that also signified that he wasn't in a mindset of choking. He knew what he had to do. He may not have executed it perfectly, but he still carried it through. It's almost like if you watch that match with the sound down, for example, and almost oblivious to what's happening on the score, I don't think you would see any clear moments where you think either of those players are losing it mentally and choking up. I'm coming back to that previous point. That's why I think over a five-set match, you have to take into account all of the ups and downs. Moments of anxiety, sure. Moments where you lose concentration, for sure. And I think if you asked Federer in a quiet corner, were there any times during that match where you choked or lost it, he'd say no. Was he 100% on every play? No, but you can't be. It's a contentious one.
And the fact that when he surfed the match, he was broken. The match went for another half an hour.
Yes, exactly.
Remembering also, this is the first Wimbledon ever where it was a tie break at 12-all.
Yeah.
If this match had been played under previous rules, I think it would have suited Federer. He looked the better during the games generally.
Definitely. You know. But it's an interesting one. I think it's one of the other topics we're going to get into. The tie break in this match. And it's only really in this match because the record of Federer for that year in tiebreaks is better than Djokovic's record in tiebreaks.
Yeah.
So you can't say Djokovic is a better tiebreak player than Federer. It was in that match, something happened in those tiebreaks. What was it?
Yeah, exactly. We've got to look at the fact that you can't underrate the history of these two guys. Federer had match points against Djokovic in two successive US Open semifinals and lost both those matches. Now, that must have been playing on his mind. You saw Mirka's face in the box when he had match point. She was having a nervous breakdown.
I've never seen Mirka so on edge in my whole life of watching Mirka, and I've watched her long and hard.
Honestly, I felt like calling a doctor.
There was something happening there, and Mirka's intensity. It was interesting, especially when you consider we're so deep into Federer's career. She's seen it all, on court and off court.
I think it's pretty obvious.
The legacy.
The legacy, and this was the opportunity. I mean, look, on that match point, the first one, it's 40-15. Federer had just got to 40-15 by serving two aces. This is in the juice court. Djokovic was expecting the one that was breaking out wide.
Mm.
And he was going that way. Federer served down the tee. The ball clips the tape. We're talking about an inch or two that defines tennis history. Djokovic was gone. That was an ace. You know, the second serve of Federer wasn't bad either, and Djokovic played it really well. Mm. So, you know, did Federer choke? No, I don't believe he choked in those moments. I think he did in the tiebreak a little bit.
Mm.
But again, it's a matter of definition.
I think even if you had him in a corner with a spotlight on him, he wouldn't be able to give you an explanation for what happened in those tiebreaks.
Yeah, but I would say if he was playing any other player, virtually any other player, I think his attitude in those points is different.
Yeah, no, I'd have to agree with that. There's certainly something about who you're playing.
The history.
What happens when two auras collide? You know what I mean? That's beautiful. You got a Djokovic aura and you got a Federer aura. What's going on when those two auras intermingle?
Just over the net.
So it's like a chemical reaction.
Yeah, don't exactly.
You think?
Exactly.
Then you throw a Nadal aura in there and you get a totally different result. Something that you can drink and that makes you happy for an hour, I believe.
15 love.
It's fair to say that Novak Djokovic is thinking about the fifth set already.
We just heard, Remo, the commentator saying, and specifically Boris Becker, I believe, the great Boris Becker, my favourite commentator, our favourite commentator.
He's a beauty, isn't he?
Oh, he's wonderful. That Novak Djokovic, in essence, tanked some games in this final. The three sets went to tiebreak, Djokovic won, and that's how he won Wimbledon. The other two sets, Federer won fairly handily, with two breaks in each. At 5-1 in the second set, Djokovic gives up the ghost. Is that a tank at 5-1?
No. I think that's just
assessing. Well, that's all, folks. See you later.
No, it's just assessing the situation and basically saying, I'm going to reserve my energy here and regroup. That happens all the time in tennis.
Federer had no opportunity or no desire to tank because he was either equal or ahead.
He was gunning for the win at every point.
Yeah.
What happens to Djokovic in matches is he has letdowns. When we're getting to the business end of tournaments against high-caliber players, you know there are going to be moments where he will come off that high level. He just does. And you can see it sometimes when he serves a double fault. He serves an awful-looking double fault where it looks like he's never served a ball in his life.
That's right.
But it's just the way he is. He cannot maintain that incredible level. You couldn't expect him to. And I think he knows it. And I think he paces himself. He doesn't panic. And he knows that he's going to come back. But there are moments there for three or four games sometimes. He looks like he's gone.
Yeah. The start of the second set of this Wimbledon, he looked awful. I think we've talked about it before with Djokovic. One of his unique tennis characteristics, which I don't think I've ever seen in another player, is that he doesn't need momentum. It's very unique. I don't think Nadal does that. I don't think Federer does that. I mean, they can come back.
Federer has his moments, though, when he goes through a sort of a shankathon where, and that's just the nature of how on the edge he plays. And you have to expect that, that when he's flying, but boy, there's small margins in terms of what Federer does. And it doesn't take too much where he's not quite timing it and the results are disastrous.
And that's another storyline we're going to cover is the great attacker versus the great defender.
The fourth set, the greatest returner perhaps in the history of our sport.
Time.
Who else would play that?
Who does these shots anymore?
Some of the greatest matches in tennis history have been played by opposites. Those who have very different styles of tennis. I'm thinking Navratilova and Evert.
Yeah.
Borg McEnroe, obviously.
Accountants versus doctors, that sort of thing.
Accountants versus doctors.
Sorry, you're talking about opposites. And I just, maybe they're not opposite enough. Maybe it's a shop assistant versus the President of the United States, that sort of thing.
In this case, we do have incredible opposites. Now, Roger Federer is one of the greatest attacking players of all time. Recently online, I saw people questioning the word attacking player. And I don't understand what the rationale behind it is. And they're saying, well, you know, Nadal and Djokovic are attacking players because of the way they play. And I think it's
on,
a different definition of what attacking
some
is.
Some people are trying to make a case for Nadal and Djokovic being great attacking players.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who are these people?
I've got their addresses if you want to hunt them down.
Yes, please. Oh, that's odd. I find that very odd.
Yeah. We're looking at Roger Federer, who is a classical attacking tennis player. Takes the ball incredibly early. Maybe as early as anyone in tennis. What do you think of that?
Oh, look, he's been known to take a ball so early that he'll take a ball the day before he plays the shot. That's early.
That is early.
And throws the rhythm of his opponents off totally. They don't know what ball they're playing.
Exactly. So when Roger Federer came onto the scene, you know, some people say revolutionised tennis the way it's played.
Yeah.
It's low percentage tennis, really, to some extent. I mean, he does have some clearance on some of his shots, but generally speaking, it's low percentage. On the other corner, we have Novak Djokovic, Remo.
And Djokovic, I agree with you. I think he is the greatest defender, and I place him ahead of Nadal in terms of his defence. The defining aspect of the Djokovic defence is his movement, in that there's nothing more galling than when you're playing somebody and you feel that you've hit the winner. And time again, it comes back. And that's what breaks you down. And Nadal does it too, don't get me wrong, but Djokovic, I've never seen anybody who has such incredible defensive skills, and essentially saying, well, what else have you got?
Yeah.
And you've played your best shots. Federer, to his credit, he can overcome that wall. But boy, he has to raise his game to such a level. And he'll come into the net and finish it, where a lot of other players don't have that in their arsenal.
He's pretty much the only one who can overcome it, really, when you think about it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. The other thing with Djokovic, he's developed that backhand where he slides his left foot out, and so he doesn't have to take the extra step that a lot of tennis players have to take on their backhand. Yeah.
He developed that through the Arthur Murray Dance School. A lot of people don't know that.
Took 2 years.
Two years.
Personal instruction.
But he's never looked back.
Never looked back. You should see him do a waltz. It's beautiful. And we'll be doing a podcast on the Wimbledon ball.
Well, can I only imagine Djokovic's movements on the dance floor, huh?
Now, the other thing to say about Djokovic is he stands behind the baseline, sometimes 1 or 2 metres.
Yeah.
And yet he has the ability to take the ball from there and turn defence into attack.
Mm.
The depth with which he hits that ball, to me, is almost his defining characteristic, as well as what you're saying, his movement. Mm. If he didn't have the ability to be able to hit the ball deep and turn defence into attack, because there are times he's on the ropes, and if you hit a short ball, well, you're gone.
Yeah.
But his ability to do that, I mean, that's why he's one of the greatest of all time.
So what are we talking about here? We're really talking about perhaps the most purest of rivalries between Federer and Djokovic. And perhaps it's a step above the Nadal-Federer rivalry. I think it is.
I think the matchup is, because, Nadal is really an outlier. Djokovic is, even though it's a slightly unorthodox way he plays, it's still a fairly common defensive pattern.
Yep.
Nadal's just out there.
In some ways, Nadal's almost manufactured, in the sense of he's the product of modern-day equipment. Racket, strings, that lasso shot that he's developed on his forehand to get that high clearance, rotations on the ball. It's almost like his game's been put together to beat Roger Federer. And he does it brilliantly, don't get me wrong, when the Nadal game has been put into place.
Yeah. I suppose what we're looking at, though, is just the difference in style between Federer and Djokovic. Mm. What was happening on the day? Federer was on top until the tiebreak. Here's an incredible stat for you.
Mm.
In those three tiebreaks, have a guess how many unforced errors Novak Djokovic made.
152?
Guess again.
Okay.
A little lower.
Three?
None.
You know, I was going to say none, but I thought, nah.
You got to trust yourself more, mate. Come on.
That's true.
And Federer made a bucket load.
Yeah.
He had a bucket.
Yeah, and he filled it.
So that was the difference. Now, we're talking about the greatest attacking player against the greatest defending player. Is Federer the greatest attacking player? Pete Sampras was a great attacking player. Rod Laver?
Yeah. When you talk about Pete Sampras, the dimensionality of Sampras's attack was so much more limited than Federer. We're talking about an incredibly broad canvas with Federer. Laver comes close, I believe, in that Laver's all court.
Yeah. Yeah, those two.
As well. They're the two. Yeah. They're the two. So, and again, when we talk about Djokovic and Nadal, the strings in the bow of Federer are many and varied. Doesn't mean that you always get the result, but we're talking now about an attacking player who can do it from every part of the court.
Yeah. I mean, in this match, it was incredible to see, even in the fifth set, and this is hours into the game, Federer playing these stop-touch volleys that were ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he's 37, almost 38. Mm. I mean, it's, you know, no matter what history says, and there's every chance that Djokovic and Nadal will take his Grand Slam record.
Sure.
But that will be something that he'll always be remembered for. He's just his flair, his touch, the style with which he played.
And in some ways, Buzz, what's more important, the number on a stat sheet or the love that you feel in your heart when you're watching a player?
Depends if you're talking to a dancer or an accountant.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to talk to both myself. Actually, my accountant is a dancer. It makes for an interesting tax return.
Does he dance while you...
Oh, yeah.
Djokovic ended
several years as number three in the world, with Federer and Nadal, who are seemingly setting new standards with possibly their finest match on this very court, the 2008 Wimbledon final. And then there was an elevation in 2011 into 2012 that was almost beyond belief. Was it the start of 2012 that he won 41 matches in a row, seven titles? It was Federer that stopped Djokovic in the semi-final of the French. It was an emotional performance. It was wonderful to watch. And other times Novak has taken it to new heights. Remember, from Wimbledon 2015 to the French Open in 2016, he won all of the slams, joining Don Budge and Rod Laver in that feat. Nobody else in this era has done that, to hold all four Grand Slams at the same time. Serena Williams, of course, has done it. Steffi Graf, she did the Golden Slam, didn't she? 88, winning the Seoul Olympics as well. But in the men's game, only this man in the modern era has done it, alongside Rod Laver.
Baz, one of the things I would like to bring up here, in terms of Novak Djokovic, is I think he's been incredibly underestimated in terms of the reboot that he's created for his career. There was that period where he was known as something of a bit of a quitter in terms of pulling out of matches. People like Andy Roddick were on his case, questioning the validity of his injuries. For a while there, it almost looked as though Novak Djokovic was going to make an exit in terms of his rise up the rankings.
Yeah, this is very early in his career. Yeah. I mean, obviously they identified him as being a major talent.
Yeah.
But you're right, yeah, Djokovic had a bit of a reputation. I think he pulled out of one Wimbledon because he had blisters.
Yeah.
A lot of the old hardheads were very, very down on him.
Mm.
But you wouldn't credit that with the Djokovic you see now.
No. And has there been any other player who has been able to rise to the challenge that Federer and Nadal have thrown down? Not really.
No, and it took
only Djokovic.
Yeah, it took him a number of years. I mean, he was young, admittedly, but only Djokovic, that's right.
The sacrifices that he would have had to have made, yeah, physically and mentally, with his diet, all sorts of things, we don't really comprehend what he's done in order to lift himself up to this level against both Federer and Nadal.
You know, I remember back to the 2009 US Open when Federer played him in that semi-final. A point before match point, Federer played that famous tweener.
Yeah.
It was a sort of feeling about Djokovic, well, he's very good, but he'll never be at this level.
Mm-hmm.
And extraordinarily, within a couple of years, he was.
Mm.
In 2011, he had one of the greatest years in tennis history.
Mm. But what I'm saying, like, no other player. Who else? Wawrinka has had his moments. Murray, of course, has had a high level of consistency. But Djokovic broke through. He's the only one who broke through.
We're going to get on to the crowd at this match soon.
Mm-hmm.
And the favouritism that Federer receives.
Yes.
And I think it's because of that favouritism that people don't really realise that in the last 10 years, it's been Novak Djokovic. Yep. It's his decade.
Yep.
Federer had that spurt, but during that spurt, Djokovic wasn't playing.
Good point.
An interesting thing. There's a very strong argument to say that Novak Djokovic is the greatest tennis player who ever lived. The fact of what you're saying, his ability to reboot, look, even in 2016-17, and he was off the tour, he had injuries, there were other personal matters,
yes,
apparently.
Yes.
I thought, that's it. When your will is gone, you don't come back. His comeback. And I've got to say, Nadal, in his career, I have never seen a player being able to retool their game, come back from injury, long layoffs, and still be competitive.
Yeah.
These guys are phenomenal.
Yep.
Federer has 2017. He does his knee. He's 36 odd. People say, well, that's probably going to be the end of Federer. He comes back after not playing for 6 months and wins the Australian Open.
Mm.
Who are these guys?
Yeah.
What's going on?
They're X-Men.
Exactly.
What's going on here? The more and more you talk about the three of them, they all have their very different styles, but then you realise just the amount of common elements that crisscross them. Yeah. Basic general things that there seems to be a pattern here about the retooling of their games. They're constantly evolving.
Yeah.
And call it stubbornness, call it commitment, call it will. We have no idea of what's going on inside these three guys.
I mean, there must be an obsessional nature to it has to be at that level.
Must be.
And while we're talking about Djokovic being young, being hammered by both Nadal and Federer, and he was.
Yeah.
Having to re-engineer his game and coming back. I think you can also say, you know, Federer coming back at 37 and being able to compete with these guys who are 5 or 6 years younger is also phenomenal. And we won't know until Djokovic and Nadal are that age. But I would not be surprised if once these three guys are retired, it never happens again, or maybe 50 years' time. I think they're going to look back at this year and just go, what was that?
Yeah, I wonder if it's something to do with the nature of the world too. I think of someone like Nick Kyrgios. He openly admits that he doesn't have it in him to win a slam, and it doesn't bother him. And he's still happy, saying he's still content to play. He has other interests. There's more things out there. Attention spans perhaps aren't what they used to be. I don't know. I'm just throwing a few things out there. And I'm just wondering if the way the world is evolving, this obsession, maybe it's something that's going to be more and more rare in athletes, in that they'll want to achieve, but maybe not to that obsessive level of these three guys, because the world's turning always and changing.
Do you think it's because those three guys were of a generation before social media, the smartphone, wider access to so many things?
Yeah.
Well, and it was more narrowly focused.
I think so. I mean, Federer grew up in the age of the dumb phone, and he credits that to his success.
I keep saying there's something magical about Roger, and everybody knows the respect they have for Novak. I think there's a lot of tennis left to be played that we have been watching it. You know, Roger could have won in straight sets, really, by the chances he's had. He hasn't faced a break point yet.
And again, you break it down. You say Federer hasn't faced a break point.
And I think that's really the way he should have, looking at things. He's been the better player, but he lost 203 sets to play. So
it's all to play for. Federer's the one that really has played all the tennis. But if we do get into that fifth set, it's going to be a fascinating one-set shootout.
Wimbledon 2019, you got these two guys coming up against each other. I can't think of another Wimbledon where someone was that dominant and lost.
No, you'd have to go through, I guess, and do a little bit of an analysis on it, but it's hard to think of a Wimbledon final, or even can you think of another Grand Slam final that you watched and thought, you know what? So-and-so really should have won that.
It was 70 years odd since someone else actually had a match point at Wimbledon and lost. Do you know who that was?
Johnny Bromwich.
And what did he say?
Ball boy, hand me the match ball.
And the ball boy didn't. And John Bromwich, God love him, tried to have that ball boy executed.
Well, he tried to sue him first, and that got thrown out of court, and then execution was his next option. But yes.
70 years.
And that story's told because of its rarity.
Yeah, and 70 years before, that was pretty much when Wimbledon started. That's a long time. But that's also, I think, segues nicely into our next topic. And that is the topic of the tiebreak.
Yeah.
And something to do with Novak Djokovic.
Given Federer's strategy and how he's played from the back of the court, it's amazing how aggressive he's played, how consistent he's been, how few unforced errors he's made. But in the first set tiebreak, the third set tiebreak, there were at least 8 unforced errors. And you look at the vast majority of this match, Federer has been the better player. But at those two critical moments, it's Djokovic that's played better.
Remo, here's a question for you. What is the true test of tennis? Now, the reason I'm asking you this is in relation to the tiebreak. Where does that sit with tennis purists?
Do I get any money if I answer this correctly?
Hold it. Yeah, you got 48 cents.
Okay, now I'm sweating. So you're asking me, where does the tiebreak sit in a game of tennis in terms of legitimacy? Is that what you're asking me?
Thank you. Yes, you've clarified.
Well, it's part of the game. It's part of the rules. It's totally legit.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If a player just played to get to tiebreaks because he knew he would win a match, do you think that's legitimate?
I think that is an absurd proposition, to be brutally honest with you.
Are you anything other than brutally honest
with
me?
So if I'm getting the theory here, you're angling here that Djokovic goes into this match angling for tie breaks because he feels he can win it. Is that what you're positing here as a theory?
All I know is every time the umpire said 6-6 tie break, Djokovic looked up at his box and winked.
So Djokovic is up in a set 5-2. He starts to worry. He throws the games until he gets back into a tiebreak position. Is that what we're saying here?
I'm not saying when Djokovic is playing Daryl Wainwright. I'm talking about when he's playing Roger Federer at Wimbledon.
Right.
Okay, Roger Federer, who's won 8 Wimbledons, who plays an incredibly aggressive style, but he knows that in the crunch moments, he feels in his heart of Djokovic hearts that he can win that tiebreak.
Sure. I mean, he's obviously not angling to get Federer into tiebreaks, but when that point emerges quite naturally, he feels an inner glow. A smug smile creeps across his dial. Is that what you're saying? Because he thinks, gotcha, Feds, gotcha. Or something like
that. Okay, well, let's look at another match. Federer versus Roddick, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Federer broke Roddick once in that match to win. Was it 16-4? I can't remember what the final set was, but it was an outrageous number of games. Once. So that means he must have won 2 tiebreaks and then won that set.
Mm-hmm.
So Federer can't complain, can he?
No.
Djokovic wins Wimbledon playing 3 tiebreaks.
Yes. That 2008 classic Wimbledon final against Nadal. Federer's only wins in the sets were in tiebreakers, I believe.
Interesting.
Mm.
So you can look at it from both ends.
Swings and roundabouts.
Both sides.
But I know what you're saying. I think Djokovic would like his chances against Federer in a tiebreak. I'm sure he would.
It's pretty incredible in that match, the difference between the games and the tiebreaks.
Yeah,
like what happens? So stark.
Okay, so what happens? What happens, as you say, when the umpire calls tiebreak? What happens to Federer?
Against Djokovic.
Only against Djokovic, I think, we can make this point. I don't think Federer's got a problem with tiebreaks per se.
Do you think it's because it's a point-for-point proposition and because Federer plays an attacking style, it's harder for him to get on top because everything he does has to be so precise?
Yeah.
A game, you know, you can go to 15-30 and you're okay.
Yeah, there's a little bit of buffer in the game.
Yeah.
Federer doesn't mind hanging off a cliff as long as he knows there's a couple of other ledges there that still give him a chance. But in a tiebreak, and he's often said it's Russian roulette, a tiebreaker.
Yeah.
It's a lottery. And maybe it's something that he needs to change in terms of his mindset.
But then on the other hand, he's had great success in tiebreaks in Wimbledon finals.
It's just the Djokovic tiebreak.
It's the Djokovic thing.
Yeah.
Those 2 US Open matches where he had match points, they were in games, they weren't tiebreaks.
Yeah.
Those games changed tennis history.
No, but
would Djokovic be Djokovic if he'd lost those 2 matches?
Oh, who knows?
I don't think he would have changed his name.
It's interesting you're saying change his name because maybe with trying to think about what Federer could do when it gets to a tiebreak with Djokovic, does he go up to the umpire and politely request that he refers to Djokovic as, I don't know, another player, just to break it.
What do you mean?
So that he thinks he's playing somebody else in the tiebreak, not Djokovic.
Right.
So are you with me here?
I'm barely with you. So the umpire says 2-1, Gene Mayer.
Gene Mayer, Andy Roddick. And Federer suddenly is relaxed and he's home.
And Djokovic is going, what? What are you talking about?
Well, okay, there's a few details that need to be ironed out here.
I'm just trying
to think of what could you do if you're Federer playing Djokovic in a tiebreaker. That's one way. I don't know. I'm just putting out some ideas here.
Okay, so this section started with a question I gave you. So
Did I answer that question? Do I get the 48 cents?
The question really is, has Novak Djokovic, the great Serbian tennis player, gamed the tennis system?
But what do you mean gamed? When you say gamed, I'm thinking of somebody walking into a casino with some kind of system up their sleeve. Is this what you're saying?
It's precisely what I'm saying. No, I don't understand that. No, it's not what I'm saying.
Oh, I don't know when you say he's gamed it. It's almost like he's manipulated it in some way.
I think more what I'm looking at is that he's looking at traditional tennis and going, puh.
Yeah, well, he says that a lot about all sorts of things. Have you ever been with him at a buffet?
Puh. So he's looking at traditional tennis scoring system and going, I don't need that. Give me a tiebreak. Just give me a normal counter.
Well,
what's this 15 juice stuff? What's going on?
Maybe he becomes some kind of braggart when a tiebreaker starts. Starts pumping his chest out, strutting around, going, tiebreaker, this is my town.
How phenomenal is it, though? Not one unforced error. That means that all the points that Federer won in those tiebreaks, he had to hit it past Djokovic. Do you know what I mean?
He
had to force him into a mistake
that
wasn't unforced.
But we're getting into a whole mindset thing here. When it comes down to a tiebreaker, Djokovic flicks a switch and something happens where he raises his level and refuses to make a mistake. Have you ever been in a room with somebody who refuses to make a mistake?
Wish my accountant was like that.
Geez, accounts are getting a lot of
airtime. They're getting a lot of airtime.
It's tax time here in Australia, and I think that's what's happening here. Accountants are on our minds. No more accountant talk, Buzz, please.
Sorry. Okay. This goes back to what you said. Was it the last section that we did where you said it's incredible how Novak Djokovic reinvented himself and became the player he did after all those pulling out of all those matches.
Yeah, yeah.
So the reputation was of someone who was mentally fragile.
Absolutely. He was pulling out of matches, remember, for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
Like dandruff.
His accountant was in the stand. Sorry. Okay.
He sprained his eyebrows once, had to go off on a stretcher. People were just thinking, what is going on with this guy? But yeah, I know.
And now he has a reputation of perhaps being the most steely tennis player who ever lived. I mean, we're talking Borg-like, Djokovic. There are not too many at that level.
You know, though, it's interesting. You have to reach a point where you are not scared of either losing or you're able to divorce yourself totally from the emotion of a situation. And I think it comes down to, is it perspective? The man has been able to come up with total 100% perspective in that moment. Is that what frees him and releases him?
He's down match point to two match points to Roger Federer on Federer's serve.
Yeah.
Federer is one of the great spot servers who ever lived.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's thinking to himself, if Federer executes superbly, he doesn't have a say.
Yeah.
So there must be a part of him that goes, I can only control what I can control, and he does that superbly. Now,
yeah.
Federer makes that first serve. We're not having this conversation. We probably aren't even doing this podcast.
It would be a celebration of Roger Federer. We would be singing songs. All sorts of things would be happening, but it wouldn't be this podcast.
No, it wouldn't be.
I'll tell you now, here's a question for you.
Oh, I like questions.
All of a sudden, you've become Ivan Ljubicic, Roger Federer's coach. Yeah.
Oh, this is a hypothetical?
This is a hypothetical.
Oh, thank God.
Okay. You're about to talk to Roger Federer because Federer is about to play Djokovic in a Grand Slam final. And you're going to say to Roger Federer, if you have match points against Djokovic, what are you going to be thinking? Are you going to be thinking about what happened previously? And if you are, how are you going to change the situation?
I don't understand the question. Are you talking to me now or Federer? Who are you talking to?
I don't understand the question. I don't know if I'm talking to you. I don't know if I'm talking to Roger Federer. Has that clarified things for you?
Are you
asking
me if I'm Ivan Ljubicic?
What do you tell Federer if you find yourself in the same situation that you found yourself before when playing Djokovic? What do you tell him?
You talk about intention. You talk about the fact you're not hoping to win this point. You go in there with the absolute steely determination and intention that this point is yours, and you play it accordingly to your best ability. John Newcombe, the great Australian tennis player who won three Wimbledons and could have won more if there wasn't that strike on, has said repeatedly, and particularly about Wimbledon, they do not give it to you. You cannot back into it. You have to take it.
Yes. What I'm getting at is that there's a pattern there with Djokovic and Federer at these key moments in these incredibly big stages.
Yeah.
And it's happened. So as the coach, you've got to come up with something to tell Roger when they play again. If this happens again, and look, there's no answer to this, I know. And anything we say sounds a bit trite, but it's to me, that's the core. That's what Ljubicic would be thinking. What do I tell this guy?
I don't think he tells him something. I think what he does, he gets Roger Federer in a warm bath.
Yeah.
He has vision of these match points against Djokovic.
Like on a loop or something?
Coming up slowly, and then just as it comes up, he tosses a toaster into the bath. It's like aversion therapy.
It's like a scene in a James Bond movie, isn't it? I'm sure I've seen that before. I'm sure. Okay. Yeah,
okay.
All right. Okay, and that solves the problem.
I think Ljubicic has done a great job with Federer.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take the 2017 Australian Open final against Nadal. I think whatever Ljubicic did with Federer was brilliant. But I think in this instance last year, I think he failed his job as a coach. I really do.
That's a bit harsh.
Well, I don't know the guy. He doesn't know me.
When we talk about how close Federer got to winning that match, at the age he is, the style he played, you're giving Ljubicic the boot.
I think how he prepared Federer for that match was genius. But in that one instance, in you know, the tie breaks and the match points were absolute crucial points in the match, and I don't think Federer was prepared properly for it. And maybe, how do you coach Roger Federer? How do you coach the guy?
Well, maybe Roger Federer would say, look, I'm in that situation. It's up to me at that point, not my coach.
You think he slaps Lubitsch when he says it?
Yeah, but he laughs when he does it, so that kind of offsets it, I think. But anyway, interesting.
How did this section start? What were we talking about? I think we're talking question.
About an accountant, I believe.
Okay.
Fine margins, very fine margins. Thank you.
This is rubbing Novak up the wrong way, I promise you.
We often talk about elephants in the room, and I think the big elephant in this room and in this match in particular has got to be the whole thing about the crowd reaction to Djokovic and the crowd reaction to Federer, and I guess the disparity therein.
Disparity is one word for it.
Mm.
It was, I've never seen anything quite like it.
No.
Outside of a Davis Cup match, perhaps, where it's more of a country, nation-based thing.
And it's not personal.
No, this is very much personality, personal-based.
Mm.
And, yeah, quite incredible scenes, particularly when Federer had match point. You had women standing up in the stands, holding one finger out, saying just one more.
Yeah.
In the fourth set, the start of the fourth set, you had Djokovic being thrown by the crowd, I believe.
Totally. Even when he was very reasonably trying to talk to the umpire over a couple of points, he's being booed. And the effect that would have on him, and I'm not talking out of school here, Djokovic wants the crowd's adoration, I believe.
Yeah,
he wants
absolutely.
It and he would feel that he deserves it in terms of his achievements and what he's done in relation to Nadal and Federer, I beg your pardon, and he's not getting it, and it's affecting him. And even Boris Becker, I believe, has commented that Djokovic is hurt by this.
Yeah, and the more he wants it, the less he seems to get it. Kyrgios famously commented on it, saying it makes him sick to see the way Djokovic tries to court the crowd. I mean, a lot of animosity there, and I'm so looking forward to their next match. So looking forward to it.
But what is it? Why is it that the masses love Federer and a lot of them Nadal? But Djokovic, not so much. What is it? What are we talking about here?
The number of people I've talked to who are, you'd say, casual tennis watchers, they enjoy watching matches. They don't know that much about tennis, but they really enjoy the Grand Slams in particular, have said to me, I don't warm to Novak Djokovic. Now, it's very interesting, isn't it?
That, it is.
You know, the way that someone comes across. He's unfortunate in the sense that he's come up against, I mean, I believe, the most loved tennis player who ever lived. I'm not sure.
More loved than Susan Longlong? I don't know.
Actually, no. Okay, maybe the most loved male tennis player.
Mm.
I think Susan Longlong is up there, to be honest.
Why don't we warm to Djokovic? The only other player off the top of my head is Pete Sampras. People didn't warm.
No.
And what was it with Sampras?
People have said that to me as well. They just did not warm to him. And
why?
It can't be just the way they play. It must be just the vibe they're giving off. But what is that? It's very ineffable, isn't it? Because someone like Bjorn Borg, for example, who we often refer to, doesn't say boo on court.
No.
And he's, I mean, very good-looking guy, looks like a Viking. Okay, he's got that in his corner.
Even still. So if Djokovic was an incredibly good-looking man, I bet this would be different. I'm sorry, I really believe that.
You're saying Novak Djokovic is ugly. Is this your...
I've told you before, I think Djokovic is a nice mix of early De Niro and early Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
And that's not that bad. Got a hell of a head of hair.
Better than my mix.
But you put him in a pocket that's kind of niche.
True.
But if he was this incredible, say he looked like, I don't know, Cary Grant. And I know I'm going back here. But imagine, okay, somebody who looked
40 or 15.
Okay, that's a bad example. But you know what I'm getting at? And I think it's worth discussing.
But okay, hold it.
Mm.
Looks is one thing. But is Federer that good looking?
Speak to a lot of women who love Roger Federer's look. And I think part of it is that he's not so good looking that he's model-like. he's good father, good looking. The sort of guy who's a good looking guy who would be a father who would look after his kids. And he's easy on the eye. He's easy on the eye.
But that's not the use. I mean, that's not the only thing.
No, no. I'm just trying to break down what are the bits here. Why?
Okay, we're looking at looks. We're looking at attitude. Obviously, Federer, as a number one when he came up, was a very magnanimous, graceful number one. We probably haven't seen that before.
Yes.
But then Johnny Mack had masses of fans. They loved him.
A lot hated him too, though.
True, he was polarizing.
He was, yes.
But he did have a lot of people who just loved the guy because, and he was a bad boy. Let's face
it. But I don't know if it was love with heart. I think it was love of attitude.
Bit of edge in there.
Edge. It's different. It's very different. But you know what? I think style of play can contribute to people loving the player. I think that if Djokovic played a swashbuckling Buccaneer type game, people would go, whoa, exactly like that, you know, that whoa. And they go, there's something about this guy I'm digging.
But now they're just going, pah.
That's right. So I do think style of play contributes. Nadal, look, a lot of people love him because there's a swagger and there's an attitude that almost radiates off the guy. And you're going, he brings you along.
Yeah, and women love Nadal. I have never spoken to as many women. This sounds a very weird sentence to begin with. Hold it. Let me just regroup here.
Yeah, okay.
So many women who are not into tennis.
And hang on. Are these women you have who you're holding against their will? I just want to make sure that...
No.
Okay, start that sentence again. That was a terrible sentence.
There are a lot of women in the world
okay.
who have not much interest in tennis who love Roger Federer. And the only reason they watch tennis is because of Roger Federer.
So why? I think it's his style of play.
You've seen it live, right? Where women, he will miss a shot.
Yeah.
And women will avert their head and they'll just go, oh my God.
Because they care about him.
Yes, it's like they could be his girlfriend, his mother, his daughter.
So there's something in Federer.
His dry cleaner.
Yes, that he brings out something in people.
That's Simon the likable.
I don't care what his name is, Chief. I like him.
That man is the most ruthless, cunning, evil, and treacherous chaos agent in the entire world. And a heck of a nice guy.
Sir, it is my duty to inform you that...
Yes?
Do you have a picture of yourself that would fit in this wallet?
Let's get back to Djokovic, though.
Okay.
Because he's not really an antagonizing kind of guy. And he had that whole period where, you know, he's the Joker. He's doing impersonations. He's being Mr. Funny Guy.
There's an edge to Novak Djokovic, I believe. There's an edge.
Yeah.
That he finds it hard to hide. Now, we've got to remember the previous number ones before Federer, a lot of them were pretty much jerky, don't you reckon? To be number one, you've got guys snapping at your heels. You've got... Federer brought in a kind of different style to number one that Nadal then, at the behest of his Uncle Tony, mirrored. Uncle Tony said, copy this guy. This guy's got
You see that guy over there? His name's Roger Federer. You see the decorum he's bringing? Copy that, my son. Well, not his son, my nephew.
It wasn't a great sentence, but he got away with it.
He did. Okay, but with Djokovic, the other thing with Djokovic, he's laid himself bare. We know... He doesn't like not being liked. And none of us do, but it's on the table now.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely
an issue in itself.
Yeah, it's like there are other players who, you wouldn't say they're not liked, but they don't get much response anyway.
No.
But I mean, then again, they're not one of the big three.
No.
So
and
it's a different level. So, okay, so let's look at this. We've got a Wimbledon final between Federer and Djokovic. Djokovic is number one player in the world. He has had an incredible number of years of being at the top.
Yeah.
And he is playing a guy. Okay, here's the other side of it. Federer is 37. People want to see him win in his twilight years of tennis.
Yeah, but we wanted to see Federer win
in his early
throughout. I know what you're getting going with.
He's monopolised the age bracket.
You're going here, where you're going to bring up people like Connors and Hewitt who weren't liked at the beginning of their careers.
That's right.
But then, as they got older, and as they made runs into tournaments, we were all for them. But Djokovic is at the top.
But there was a sense that Federer was a definite underdog in this final. Even with his record and how great he is, because he lost two to Djokovic, even when he played a brilliant match and was clearly the better player for most of it, there was still the sense that he was the underdog.
Look, do you think it's time to bring in somebody now who knows a lot about popularity and tennis players, what makes them tick, and what switches are flicked in order for us to warm to players?
Who are you talking about? You're not talking about...
The one and only.
Is he here?
I hope he's here, otherwise we're in trouble.
Let's bring him into the studio.
Mr. Teddy Shingles. Teddy, take a seat.
Hey, Teddy. Hello, boys. It's wonderful to be here. Absolutely wonderful.
Now, you've been listening in most attentively to what we've been talking about here, especially in this latter part of the podcast, in terms of Novak Djokovic, his apparent unpopularity in comparison to Roger Federer.
Yes.
And the fact that he longs for nothing more than to want to be loved like all of us do as human beings. Now, Teddy, have you got a general take before we drill down into this about what's going on here?
Can I first just say that I was brought into saying this was going to be a very short podcast, a very brief one about one particular match, and on we go into the second hour. It's almost longer than the match itself. I think we need a tiebreak.
And who would win that?
Well, certainly Roger Federer. I'm glad he's not here. But it's a very interesting point about the crowd. I was there that day, you know. I was in the crowd, and it was the atmosphere. Well, you know the saying, you could cut it with a knife. You could have cut it with a feather. That makes sense? I'm not sure.
No, I know where you're going.
Yes. No, you couldn't have cut it with a feather. It was way too thick for that. You would have needed a chainsaw.
Dear.
But I don't think you could really rev one up in the middle of a Wimbledon crowd, could you? It was incredible every time. Well, at the start of the match, it was fairly restrained, I must say. There was obviously Federer had the crowd.
Yes.
But it wasn't riotous.
No.
There was decorum. People were behaving themselves.
Yeah, but then their masks eventually slipped when Federer got close to winning that match, yeah?
Well, I think in the fourth set, people could, at the start of the fourth set in particular, Djokovic was up 2 sets to 1. The feeling was Federer had put up a wonderful show.
Yes.
But the feeling also was, well, maybe it's over. He's not getting any younger. How many of us are?
No, yes.
And so as the set wore on, the crowd started to get rambunctious. They started to get involved, and you could see it viscerally attacking Djokovic as if, well, what's going on here?
Were you sitting next to any people who were getting involved in some of this behaviour against Djokovic, or was it something that you sensed?
There was a couple next to me, and the woman and the man, they were sort of whispering together, and the gist of it was they were planning some kind of coup against Djokovic. One of them pulled out of her purse, well, I suppose it was the woman, wasn't it, pulled out of her purse a small device that I believe she was aiming towards Djokovic and trying to change his brain patterns.
Right, that's very specific. Okay, and do you think it worked?
I know that Djokovic glanced over at one point, but I think it could have been coincidental.
Right.
And then she dropped it and it was aimed at her and she started talking in Egyptian.
So after that incident, did you notice anything else happening?
Oh, it was getting rather tense. Federer was broken early in the fifth set. I don't know if you remember. I don't know if you've covered this, but Federer was broken. And the feeling was, well, it was a good fight. But his time is done.
Yes.
And then surprisingly, Djokovic came up to serve.
Yeah.
And a wall of sound hit him that he may not have ever heard. It was like a dam had broken and it was about to engulf a village and the villagers were running screaming from the village and trying to get onto the nearest road. But there was traffic and they couldn't get out of the village because the traffic had blocked them in. If you imagine some roundabouts with traffic going around the roundabouts, they can't get through the roundabouts because there's too much traffic in the roundabouts.
Yes.
And so they're trying to get through and then they get out of their cars and the water's coming.
That's a lot to take in for, for Novak Djokovic in the fifth set of a Wimbledon and final, my goodness.
Absolutely, but I think he got the gist of it. Anyway, Federer broke back. And I tell you, the roar of that crowd was something you have never heard. It actually affected me. I think my adrenal glands were slightly put out.
I see.
Yes. Teddy, can I just cut in here? What is it about Novak Djokovic It doesn't inspire us to enjoy him, to warm to him.
To want to hug him. Have you ever, either Teddy or Buzz, have you ever felt that you wanted to hug Novak Djokovic? I wouldn't.
Well, I have hugged Novak Djokovic.
You have?
Okay. Yes, I've hugged a lot of tennis players, but Novak Djokovic, once upon a time, he lost a match and he was devastated. And he came out, we know each other, of course. And he came up to me and said, "Well, Teddy, that one got away from me." And I said, "Come here, young man." He was 22 at the time. And he folded into my arms like a young Grace Kelly. And I hugged him. And that hug lasted for about 3 minutes, I believe.
3 minutes. That's a long time for a hug.
I thought he was sobbing into my shoulder. But later I found out he was just dribbling a little bit. It was not great. But afterwards he looked at me and he had small tears in his eyes. And he said, "Teddy, will I ever win the love of a crowd?" And I said, "Novak, probably not."
Well, Teddy, I want to ask you something. Is it possible for a player to somehow cultivate a relationship with the crowd in the first couple of games of the set? And once that happens, is it possible then for it to develop to a point where a bond forms, possibly a relationship, and maybe even some kind of spiritual consummation down the road at another tournament? Do you know what I mean? Is there something that can evolve and develop here?
It has to evolve, as you say, very subtly.
Right.
I don't think it's something that... Well, I think Novak sometimes has tried too hard. I've seen him at tournaments going through the crowd, handing out small cards with his bio on it and small gifts giving to all the crowd.
Chocolates and flowers?
Chocolates, some perfume occasionally, and oh, it was stinky.
You cannot accuse him of not trying and working hard to form some kind of bond there.
And do you know, Teddy, has Novak ever said something about this affecting him on court? Well, no, not on court. He hasn't said anything that was overtly that it's affecting his tennis game. But I've seen him in practice, and sometimes he'll hit a shot and he'll look up at that where he thinks the crowd would be, and he smiles and he winks and he does a little wave. And he's practicing this. It just doesn't work. There's something not quite right about
it. That's very sad, in a way, in the sense of him practicing this on the court. And then when the match comes around, the response is not forthcoming. I feel a little bit sad when you tell me a story like that, Teddy.
It's one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. In that Wimbledon final, when Roger Federer had match points, I must admit, and I love Roger with all my heart, but my heart leapt out at the young Serbian. I thought, what must he be going through knowing that all these people want him to fail?
Yes.
And to his great credit, and I think very cleverly, he held it in. He did not give the crowd any fuel.
No.
But when he won, I don't know if you saw it, when he won, he didn't jump up and down as some of these clowns do when they win Wimbledon.
No.
He looked up, he knew what he'd done, and he didn't want to antagonize the crowd, but he walked towards the net. And you might say there's no love lost between Roger and Novak, but the respect is there.
Oh, it's there, yeah. He normally will eat some of the Wimbledon grass. Did he do
that? He did. He got down and he ate some. He took some away for later as well.
Yeah, well, he brings some condiments out too, I think. A bit of salt, pepper, and a bit of cayenne.
Shrichinri chili, I believe, a little bit of sauce, to put on it.
And, yes.
But look, you're talking about the fact that Roger Federer had the crowd behind him, and that Novak Djokovic doesn't have the crowd behind him. And it's one of those ineffable things, isn't it? You mentioned Jimmy Connors before. Well, the start of his career, he was not a fan favourite at all.
Oh, no.
By the end, he was in his late 30s.
Yes.
The crowd warmed to him.
They loved him.
None of the players warmed to him.
No.
Certainly in the locker room, there was, yes, he... He didn't have any friends, really, very few. But
Teddy, we need to end this podcast here because, as you said, this was originally, I think, scheduled for 10 minutes, and I think we've gone a little bit over time. What words of advice would you give to Novak Djokovic in terms of his relationship with crowds and the way he feels about being loved?
Well, I don't want to sound self-centred.
No.
But I think he needs a new wardrobe. I'd like to dress the man.
Dress him for love.
I would dress him for the love of the crowd.
And what would that be, Teddy?
I think that would be a wonderful one. I'm just thinking now because I can see some designs swimming up before my eyes.
Would a bow tie come into play here?
Never. Bow tie is... I'm surprised you brought... You know better than that, Remo. A bow tie...
I was just clutching here, Teddy. No, please, sorry. Oh, excuse me. What would you suggest for Novak in terms of dressing... for the love of the crowd.
It's a very subtle thing. It's not a particular piece of clothing. You wouldn't say, well, he should wear tails and a top hat, for example.
No.
Or he should wear a particular cut of pant.
Mm.
But I think that there's certain subtle elements of a crease here, a button there. Mm. They could turn the crowd in his way.
Very subtle.
Very, very subtle. But you've got to understand, in private, he's a charming man.
Mm.
And his wife, a wonderful woman. And I won't hear a word against either of them.
No. Okay.
Well, Teddy, just one last question. You were there on the day. Do you think the better player lost that final? I know we're talking about favouritism and crowd and whatever, but do you think the better player lost that final? That's an excellent question, Buzz. Thank you. No. I think Roger Federer had the bulk of that game, the greater majority of time, he was clearly the better player. But how do you judge a tennis match?
Mm.
When it comes down to those tiebreakers, we all know it's crunch time.
Yeah.
And Novak Djokovic, the love of the crowd flowing in the opposite direction, like a magnet, pushing him away, was able to suck it up and gain a fabulous victory. And my hat goes off to him, my hat goes off to Roger. But, you know, perhaps on a more sentimental note, I personally think that tennis maybe owed Roger Federer that match. Think of it this way. He wins the match. He's beaten Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic at the age of 37, almost 38 at Wimbledon. It doesn't matter then if those two men overtake him, as they might well do in future, because he always will be able to have that to talk to Merker about when he's older, as he's drifting up to sleep just to remember holding up that trophy. But sport, as we know, is not an easy mistress. And he was denied. And so now he must live the rest of his life in dreadful regret. And hopefully, by the time he dies, and hopefully that's many years away, he has reconciled himself to the fact that life is life.
And that's it. On a massive miss hit, Wimbledon number 5 for the Serbian superstar. What a treat this has been. The top seed triumphs, and it can surprise no one. He's beaten Roger Federer today in the longest final in Wimbledon history.